On Robinhood Radio, it's time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage. David is a multimedia journalist with an online column at themediabeat.com and has reported since 2012 for the PBS network, mainly on ethical issues. He is also the author of a memoir, A Question of Paternity, Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning August 15th, 2025. So the stage is set. Today, in America's 49th state, the top leaders of two big nations meet to decide, in a pattern familiar through the ages, the fate of a smaller nation. The choice of venue is resonant, Alaska. So resonant with history regarding the roles played by those bigger nations in the territory's life. Not least, domination by Tsarist Russia in the late 18th century, when Alaskans were cruelly exploited with forced labor. Russian control for about 125 years is still felt in everyday ways. Russian food available for sale in Anchorage City grocery stores, that kind of imprint. And why is there any historical connection at all? It came about, of course, through simple geography. The Bering Strait, after all, part of the North Pacific, amounts to just 50 miles or so of separation between Russia and Alaska. This often comes as something of a surprise to journalists when, rather rarely, as now, national attention must focus on our furthest western state, purchased from Russia in 1867. A little pinprick of surprise is perhaps understandable, given that our national media are much more used to thinking of the Atlantic as our major dividing ocean, separating Europe from us, the old world from the new. That proximity via the Bering Strait was once famously summed up by our one-time candidate for the U.S. vice presidency, Sarah Palin, who was, lest we forget, governor of Alaska. In an apparent claim to have some international relations expertise, Palin supposedly said, "I can see Russia from my house." Like many quotations that sound too good to be true, it isn't true. Not quite, anyway. I had to qualify my citation with the word "supposedly said," because in fact it was her consummate impersonator, Tina Fey, who uttered those exact words on a broadcast of a Saturday Night Live show. In defense of Fay and the SNL writers' room, if they need any defending, what Palin herself said to Charlie Gibson of ABC News was not, in fact, so far from the priceless SNL fiction. She actually said, "There are next-door neighbors, and you can actually see Russia from land here in Alaska." She was talking about offshore islands, and indeed, rather than 50 miles or so, something more like only 3 miles or less separate one isolated American spot of land from a Russian spot. There's also, on the map at least, the dot and dash lines of the International Date Line running right through the middle. It's one day on the Russian side, another day, one behind, on the US side. All this is prologue for pointing out that even while losing a day on his eastward trip, Vladimir Putin, the modern-day Tsar, will likely feel very comfortable at this summit, with a lot more than distant history and watery geography to provide such comfort. Diplomatically speaking, he's been here before. Previous exchanges between the two leaders have shown Trump to be more than ready to accept Putin's view of the world. Earlier this year, after speaking with Putin, he claimed Ukraine was to blame for Russia crossing its border to attack the smaller nation. And in February, he ordered the U.S. to break with all its traditional allies and vote against a United Nations resolution condemning what everyone else saw as Russia's aggression. And just as a further indicator of Trump's own Putin-influenced outlook, let me allude to one indisputable piece of consensus. This summit is notable in part, maybe even especially significant, for taking place on what the press is universally and correctly calling American soil. I highlight this because Trump himself seems to have a hazy grasp on what is American soil. In the White House on Monday, he more than once told reporters he was, quote, going to Russia on Friday. Maybe Putin has been whispering in his ear that Alaska is really still Russian territory. No wonder that Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky worried out loud this week that Mr. Trump could easily be, I quote, deceived by Putin. Zelensky's many supporters among European governments joined in that worry. Sensibly enough, ahead of the Alaska meeting, they tried to win Trump's ear, and ideally, if possible, his understanding, with Wednesday's electronic conferencing of leaders. Originally convened by Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz, the virtual meetings were attended by chief executives of countries from the UK and France to Poland, right on Russia's border, plus multinational groupings like the NATO Military Alliance and the European Union. Crucially, Zelensky himself was included too, and the hope, maybe very forlorn, was expressed that he'd also be invited to the Alaska talks, perhaps some way into the process. That was all predictable enough, but one slight surprise came in the pre-summit hullabaloo when America's ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, said it was quote-unquote possible that Zelensky could be invited. But then, he's Trump's appointee in this second term to represent the U.S. in NATO, and that may not be, we must acknowledge, a strongly reliable position from which to know Trump's thinking. We might recall from 2018, during the first Trump administration, when Whitaker was in the Justice Department, that Trump declared on Fox News, "I can tell you Matt Whitaker is a great guy. I mean, I know Matt Whitaker." But then he also told White House pool reporters on the South Lawn only 4 weeks later, when he'd just promoted Whitaker to acting Attorney General, "I don't know Matt Whitaker." What can we conclude? Apart, that is, from how dispiriting it must be to have Donald J. Trump as your boss. But as for any conclusion about Zelensky's possible role in the Alaska talks, nothing. Nada. Zilch, of course. But Trump himself has suggested that a follow-up meeting, quote, almost immediately, might be when Zelensky could join the other two leaders. Let's shift focus for a moment. Strategic analysts in Europe are now making some arguably bleak, maybe brutally realpolitik forecasts for how the Ukraine war might go post-Alaska talks, with Zelensky's eventual involvement or without it. I'm going to discount for now American intelligence agencies' expectations, even their off-the-record predictions, since these can often seem depressingly prone to partisan political influence. And by this I mean, of course, crude Trump loyalist influence. The view from Europe is that Trump's mutterings about, quote, land swaps indicate a plan for Ukraine to withdraw its troops, however unwilling it might be, from Donetsk and Luhansk in the country's eastern region of Donbass. The plan would, overall and in essence, freeze the front line just where it is right now and hand Russia de facto control of the territory it occupies. This notion has already and inevitably compelled Zelensky to emphasize that his country's constitution expressly forbids this from happening, without, that is, a referendum of the country's entire population, something that's a practical impossibility, given Russia's occupying presence in nearly a fifth of the country. Putin's thought for circumventing such an obstacle would be typically Machiavellian. He could withdraw Russian forces from the northern region of Sumy and neighbouring Kharkiv. He could then present to the world, at least to his main audience in the Oval Office, the argument that Zelensky was then the main impediment to peace. He would work, like the devious former KGB officer he will always be, on destabilizing Ukrainian society further by stirring grievances among the minority who are willing to accept concessions in order to end the suffering of war. That minority, by the way, is shown in polling by the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology to amount to 38% of Ukrainians. They said in a June survey that they're willing to accept territorial losses, quote, in order to achieve peace, unquote. By contrast, a majority of just 52% were firmly against giving up land, even if, quote, this makes the war last longer. One possibility being whispered about in Europe's diplomatic corridors is to draw a page from a playbook adopted on the other side of the world, the agreement of 1997 between China and Britain over the future of Hong Kong. It may seem fanciful, but it is seriously being considered. That Sino-British deal saw Britain return sovereignty to China, but on condition that it would maintain Hong Kong's special status, that is, retaining many British characteristics, including some democratic mechanisms, for 50 years. Ukraine and Russia could possibly, it's argued, agree to recognize the Donbass areas as legally Ukrainian, but governed for a set period of time as if they belonged to Moscow. Proponents of this plan say the bloodshed would stop and a line in the sand would be drawn for now. Inevitably, though, Moscow would work on cultivating more pro-Russian support in the areas it controlled. International supporters of democracy can cite glumly the increasingly totalitarian hold that China now has over Hong Kong, and the same could very well prove true in Moscow-controlled stretches of Ukraine, however supposedly temporary that control is meant to be. Will such an arrangement be raised in Alaska today, or will it be lying in wait as a scheme for some time in the future? In the time-honored phrase of political observers everywhere, and a phrase now used irritatingly often, I regret to say, by the so-called leader of the free world himself, we will have to wait and see. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.com.